morning and welcome to another of the Greens List breakfast briefings. Peter Pascoe is my name and I've been allocated the task of chairing this morning's session. As I hit the snooze button this morning, I thought, how did this all come to be? Getting out of bed early, having to chair a session. I seem to recall a conversation with Michael that went along something of the same lines as I'd heard him speak about before when other chairmen had been conscripted to office. It went something like this. Peter, we've lost Kate McMillan to the Supreme Court. Tony Southall's finished his trial commitments and he's leaving early for the Cup weekend. John Nunns has done his tour of duty last time. You're it. Before I could utter the words, yes, boss, I heard Michael quickly say, there are two simple rules that I want you to follow. Being a quick-witted barrister, I was nearly going to object to the use of the word simple when directed to me, but I thought the better of it. After all, I've been insulted by experts and most of them are judges. Michael's two simple rules were, stick to the timetable and don't make a dickhead of yourself. Sorry, I perhaps used the wrong word there. He was probably more polite. I thought long and hard about those two rules. Adopting the Bridget Jones idiom, I made two memos to myself. First memo was, try awfully hard to ensure we stick to the timetable. Be firm but polite with speakers. Don't allow excessive questioning from the audience. Second memo to self was, don't volunteer supplementary answers to difficult questions directed to the panel. With those opening remarks, let me extend a warm welcome to you for coming this morning. And it's the second of our probate breakfasts. And we have two speakers from our list, Jeremy Smith, who's going to kick off, and is going to be followed after the second break by Catherine Hamill. Two topics are very much to the fore in practice and thinking about matters relating to probate wills and estates, statutory wills from Jeremy, and removal of executors from Catherine. As the first speaker devoting his energies to statutory wills, I thought, well, I think I know how to introduce Jeremy. After all, I've opposed him, I've mediated him, I've had common causes with him. I thought he was a one-trick pony. I thought he was a member of the probate bar, pure and simple. But lo and behold, I looked at his CV that was given to me, and has he got an extensive CV. And his talents don't just extend to the areas of wills and probate and estates. Slater and Gordon was his background. Did I hear anyone in the audience mutter Julia Gillard? I think I also heard equity participation. I must ask Jeremy about that later on. He had a background in industrial and employment law. Again, I was unaware of it. I'm glad I'm now aware of it. And more allied, perhaps, with the probate area is commercial equity and matters relating to undue influence and the like. Jeremy also has an extensive background outside of his pursuit of the law, and he is involved with his wife in an art gallery called Gallery Smith, and commendably, he's the president of the Children's Cancer Centre Foundation, which has been established to support the clinical and research work of the Children's Cancer Centre at the Royal Children's Hospital. With that extensive background for you to be able to appreciate Jeremy's offering this morning, I'll ask Jeremy to present his paper for you.
Thank you, Peter. I think that's okay. I'm talking today about statutory wills, and when we were discussing between ourselves some months ago what might be an appropriate topic for these, or appropriate topics for these seminars, I'd recently been involved in a couple of statutory wills applications, and I thought that it was suitably interesting. I should say at the outset, the applications are reasonably uncommon, but I think that's sort of all the more reason to have a seminar about them and to assist people to recognise the circumstances where an application of this nature might be appropriate. And I hope that this seminar assists you in that regard. The concept of courts making a will on behalf or approving a will on behalf of a person who doesn't have capacity is relatively recent. I've set out on the first page of the paper some references to the situation in the UK, where the UK courts have had the jurisdiction to effectively write wills for people without capacity since about 1969. Now, there are some contrasts to be noted between the UK situation and the situation as applies in Victoria, but I've put the UK references up front because in quite a few of the authorities, the courts make reference to the situation in the UK and particularly the differences, but also the similarities. And perhaps the most important reference in those authorities is the reference to the decision of the decision in Reed D, which I've referred to at paragraph 4. Now, in that case, the court set out five sort of broad principles to assist judges in what is a fairly wide-ranging task of trying to determine what should go into the will of a disabled person. And I've set them out there. The first is that in determining the intentions of the patient, assume a brief lucid interval at the time the will is made. So suddenly the person snaps out of their dementia or brain injury or whatever it might be and has a few clear moments to reflect on what should go in his or her will. And assume the patient is fully informed of the past, so they know what's happened in the past, and they know that they better get the will done shortly because they're going to relapse. And the court also then needs to look at the likely views of that person and not some hypothetical person. So it's a matter of looking at the information or evidence concerning that person, not some idealised person. The fourth point, which I've indicated there, is assume the patient is being advised by competent solicitors. And this is a very important assumption which becomes prominent in the Victorian cases as well. And finally, assume the patient is adopting a broad brush rather than an accountant's pen. And that's something which has been picked up in the most recent Victorian decision. So the court in that case said that the role is to make a disposition according to the principles or factors stated, so those five principles, and the general requirement of fairness and appropriateness for all concerned. I'm not so sure whether that applies in Victoria, given that none of the decisions refer to fairness, and certainly the Act doesn't refer to fairness. So presumably the people in Victoria turned their eyes to the UK and decided it would be a good idea if we had something similar. And I've referred there to two Law Reform Committee reports in 1985 and 1995. And by reason of those, the Part 3 of Division 2 of the Wills Act came into effect in 1998. Now, I'm going to take you through the statutory provisions and then go to some of the cases. I'll just highlight some of the most important elements of the statute. Probably the first thing to understand before you read it is that there is a requirement for leave, and then there's the substantive application. I think it becomes apparent when you read the cases that there's not much distinction to be made between the two, but that's the way the section is structured, and to the extent that it's a bit repetitive, or these sections rather, to the extent that they're a bit repetitive, that's the explanation. There are two aspects to the application. So Section 21 talks about the court's power. It refers to three things. Firstly, that the person must be... the court can authorise a will for a person who does not have testamentary capacity. Secondly, leave must be obtained. And thirdly, the order may not be made if the person is deceased. So in terms of leave, the court, Justice Gillard's described that as a screening process. I'm not convinced it works in that way, but that seems to be the purpose of it. In terms of the order not being made if someone is deceased, the issue there becomes fairly obvious for a practitioner. If you have a person who is very unwell, and you're concerned that an application is appropriate, you need to get your skates on. Because if that person dies before the order is made, then their will or their intestacy will stand. Section 26 is really the nub of the whole legislative structure. These are the things, the matters of which the court must be satisfied. The first is the person doesn't have capacity. The second at 26B is that the court must be satisfied that the proposed will reflects what the intentions of the person would be likely to be, or what the intentions of the person might reasonably be expected to be if he or she had testamentary capacity. So most of the cases dwell on that form of words and try to establish what precisely it means in the given situation. And 26C is that the court must be satisfied that it's reasonable in the circumstances to make the will. So that really is a discretionary element which is introduced. Now, just one observation about Section 26B. As I say, that's the critical part of this legislation. After 1998, or rather when it was initially introduced in 1998, the formulation was slightly different in that subsection. And I've reproduced the words there in paragraph 11. The court had to be satisfied that the proposed will accurately reflects the likely intentions of the person if he or she had testamentary capacity. Now, in 2007, those words were amended and the word accurately was removed and the word reasonably was inserted amongst other changes. So the reason for that appears to be the judgment of Her Honour Justice Dodd Streeton in Bolton and Sanders, which I'll come to in due course. But essentially what the legislature did in 2007 was make it easier for the court to approve a statutory will and require less certainty or less precision in the mind of the court in considering the application. So I'll come back to that shortly. I've set out there the provisions of Section 27. Just briefly, it's one of these provisions where the court can inform itself in any manner it sees fit. It's not bound by the rules of evidence, and can determine the leave application together with the substantive application. And my footnote there refers to the fact that in all of the Victorian cases, the courts have dealt with leave and the substantive application at the same time. So hence my comment, I'm not sure really what the point of the leave provision is, but there you go. Section 28 is the other important part of the scheme. It sets out all of the things that the court may wish to hear about. So if you're drawing an affidavit in support of an application, you must look at this section and you must address it. So most of those matters are, as you'd expect, the written statement of the general nature and reasons for the application, estimate of the size and character of the estate, draft of the will, of course. 28D, any evidence of the wishes of the person. And that's obviously very important. And that's where a lot of the cases turn. Evidence of a person regaining testamentary capacity, terms of any previous wills, likelihood of a Part 4 application being made. And that's also a very important consideration in these decisions. Evidence of the circumstances of people for whom provision might reasonably be made, people who may claim on intestacy, that's also important. Gifts to charities, any evidence of those and any other evidence relevant to the application. And it's that last consideration which is where it permits you to introduce evidence of misbehaviour by anyone who's relevant to the application. And that's a feature of some of these decisions as well. And section 29 talks about those entitled to appear on an application. Obviously, the administrator of a person without capacity may appear, and anyone with a genuine interest. The rules, Order 17, deals with some of the formalities. I won't go to that in particular, but it talks about what needs to be in the affidavit and what notice needs to be given. Justice Gillard dealt with the notice requirements in Monger and Taylor, which appears to be the first decision in the under these provisions. And I've just extracted there at page 4 some of his observations, and if you are preparing an application, you really need to turn your mind to those. It's important to consider everyone who may have an interest and put them on notice of the application before the first directions hearing. Who might have an interest? Well, beneficiaries under an old will, a person entitled on an intestacy, those who may have a claim more generally on the bounty of the testator or testatrix. So His Honour's decision in Monger and Taylor, as I said, is the first one. It concerned a person lacking capacity who was intestate. And on the intestacy, her estate would go to her sister, who hadn't seen her for 38 years and who she didn't like very much. So there was an application by a friend who had been close to her for many years and taken good care of her. He applied for the making of the approval of a will, which obviously favoured him and his wife. Their case was initially contested, and then at, I think, a fairly late stage, it was compromised, and the parties served up to the court a will which provided for a 50-50 split between the friend and the sister. So you need to bear in mind that these applications may be opposed, but they may also be compromised. That, of course, doesn't mean that the court simply rubber stamps the will. The court has to be satisfied of the requirements of the Act, and particularly that it reflects the intentions of the person. So that decision, His Honour discussed the British authorities, talked about the requirements of the Act, and I won't dwell upon it. Suffice to say, he accepted the compromise. He accepted that it satisfied the requirements of the Act. But it is a very comprehensive decision and goes through things in a very, very careful fashion. The second case there at paragraph 19 is Hill against Hill and the Cat Protection Society. There, an elderly lady had made a will and she had left half to her daughter and half to her half to the Cat Protection Society. And the daughter came along to the court and said, look, here's a will which leaves everything to me. Because before she lost her capacity, our relationship improved. Mum was talking about the fact that she wanted to alter her will. Mum thought I didn't have enough resources because I'm pretty poor and don't have much going for me. So there was evidence from various people which corroborated that. The application was hotly contested by the society, and but Justice Byrne accepted the evidence that she regretted the terms of her will, and he also accepted that the daughter, were this will not made, the daughter would have a pretty good Part IV claim. And so that weighed fairly heavily in his deliberations. So the new will was authorised. And I have a bit more to say about that case at the end in relation to costs. The paragraph 20 is Fletcher and Papaleo. This is an interesting case as well. In fact, they're all pretty interesting cases on their facts. This involved a family, an elderly lady who had left her estate to her children to be shared equally. One of the children was a bit of a scallywag, and he had borrowed a lot of money from Mum and Dad before Dad died and Mum lost capacity. And not only had he borrowed money, but he'd taken out a loan secured with their house as security. And he didn't repay it, and the house got sold up, and the money got taken from the proceeds of sale. Now, Justice Byrne, whilst not particularly impressed with the son, was considering an application where he was going to have his share of the estate reduced by the amount that had been taken or borrowed by him over the years. Now, that sounds pretty fair, but again, it's not a case of fairness, it's a case of looking at the intentions or likely intentions of the person who no longer has capacity. And in that case, Justice Byrne said, it's a serious step to make or to modify a will. It's not for me to impose upon Mrs. Fletcher an intention which I think she might or ought to have had. The section requires that I make a finding as to her supposed likely intentions. The application requires me to make a finding that her likely intentions are those set out in the proposed statutory will. This I'm unable to do. So he simply wasn't sure. Maybe Mum would have excluded the son or reduced his entitlement. Maybe she wouldn't. In paragraph 21, I've talked about state trustees and Hayden. This is a case where there's a bit of misbehaviour as well, of a more extreme nature than in the case I've just talked about. In this case, Mrs. Slate, an elderly lady, appointed Mr. Hayden as her administrator, or rather he was her administrator, he was a fiduciary. He borrowed some money from her. Well, I'll go back a step. The first thing is she made a will in which he was to receive her house and he was to receive half of the residue. And the estate was worth about $1.7 million. And I think it was a house in South Melbourne. He wasn't satisfied with that. He went and convinced her to lend him some money. And she lent him, and she was incapable, she lent him $320,000. He invested it in a business which, of course, went bust. Before he did so, he got the approval of the Guardianship Board for the loan. But the court found, Justice Mandy noted two things about that. The first one was he was surprised that the Guardianship Board would ever approve an unsecured loan in that sum. But secondly, he found that the Mr. Hayden had misled the Guardianship Board. And I've extracted what I think are the relevant parts of His Honour's decision there, and you can read them at your leisure. But in terms of, you know, how do you deal with a person who is in your will but has misbehaved, or in the will of the person lacking capacity but is misbehaved? His Honour says it, I've extracted at 22, I consider the defendant's conduct in relation to Mrs. Slate would be considered by most people to be reprehensible and disgraceful. He goes on to say, I consider that Mrs. Slate in her position, if possessing testamentary capacity, is very likely to have reacted in the way most normal, decent people would react and view the defendant's conduct as reprehensible and disgraceful. And so a new will was made excluding Mr. Hayden. And quite rightly so, you would think. I've referred there also to two cases, Ree Palmer, a decision of Justice Ashley, and Nan Caro. Those two cases concern people who don't Nancarrow concerns a child, Palmer concerns a young man who had a brain injury from birth. So it wasn't possible for the court to look at his preferences and inclinations when he had capacity. But there's an extract I've set out there, which is the court ought to assume that the person is a normal, decent person acting in accordance with contemporary standards of morality, and that assists the court in determining what's appropriate for a person in that position. Now, I've referred to Bolton and Sanders earlier. This is a decision that is worth reading fairly closely. It's the leading judgments written by Justice Dodd Streeton, and it's very comprehensive. The situation was that there was the lady had an elderly lady had a will, one of the beneficiaries died, there was going to be effectively be an intestacy. Mrs. Bolton came along, who was a friend of hers, and said, look, here's a new will, and I've divided it up very fairly. I get some, and so do the nieces and nephews who will take on intestacy, and so do these charities. Now, Her Honour went back through the English authorities, identified the differences between the English authorities and the Australian English system and the Australian system, which is effectively that a British judge can write a will, a Victorian judge can only approve a will, and the focus in Victoria is on the likely intentions of the person, whereas in the UK it's a far broader brush. Now, I won't dwell too much on this case, but what Her Honour said was that I'm referring to the extract in paragraph 27. She said 26B requires satisfaction on the balance of probabilities that the proposed will accurately reflects the testator's likely intentions. The question is not whether the testator would probably have preferred the proposed will to intestacy, nor whether the proposed will is one of a number of possible proposed wills, all of which might be equally likely to reflect the testator's intentions. If the proposed will no more probably reflects likely intentions than a number of other possible dispositions, in my view, the requirements will not be satisfied. So it's not just good enough to come up with something that would probably be acceptable when there are any number of variations which would also probably be acceptable. There were two more cases, Plowright and Burge and DeGoy and Corp, which were came before the court before the change in 2007. I'll let you look at the notes there about those cases, but you may recall the case in relation to Corp. This is the situation where Mrs. Corp was, or Mr. Corp and his lover attempted to murder Mrs. Corp, and she was found critically ill and was on life support for some time. She had a will in which she left everything to her husband, who, as it turned out, tried to kill her and did in fact kill her. And so whilst she was on life support, the application was made and a statutory will was approved, excluding her husband. The application was made by her adult daughter from a previous relationship. There's an interesting sort of evidentiary question which arises in that situation, which is, well, the police have charged the fellow, but there's been no trial. How do you establish that he did in fact attempt to kill her? In this case, it appears that the application wasn't opposed and the court accepted evidence, and it's a bit unclear precisely what form it took, but accepted the police summary, which I presume had been put before the court in the bail application or at some stage. It's not clear whether the affidavit was sworn by a police officer or whether a solicitor had put it in on information and belief, but there's a relaxation of the rules of evidence, and I'm not sure to what extent it was an issue, but you can see perhaps why the legislature has contemplated a relaxation of the rules of evidence in a situation like that. The amendments came around in 2007, and I've talked about those already in paragraph 11. As far as I can tell, the only judgment delivered since the amendment is the case of state trustees against Doe and Nguyen. In that case, an elderly lady had made a will in which it had the effect of leaving everything to her neighbours, Mr. Doe and Mrs. Nguyen. And it was also apparent on reading the will that she'd made a wrong assumption. She thought she had gifted her real estate, her home, to her solicitor, when in fact the solicitor had renounced the gift. So she didn't realise that her house still formed part of her estate and she was leaving that to her neighbours. Now, the fact that she was gifting her house to her solicitor says something about her state of mind at the time.
And in fact, Justice Bell noted that she'd made about 8 wills in the course of the preceding 10 years, and he wasn't convinced that any of them were valid, but some of them plainly were not valid. So in this case, state trustees commenced an action in the county court against these neighbours to recover a substantial sum of money which she had gifted to them in the course of a period where she plainly didn't have capacity, although there was an issue about that and it was defended. And on day 6, the case settled. And at the same time, state trustees had issued an application for a statutory will excluding the neighbours from this lady's will. The case settled in the county court. The proceeding was going on in the Supreme Court, and it settled as well at a mediation. And the will, which is ultimately authorised, reduced the stake of the defendants from 100% down to 12.5%. Now, His Honour Justice Bell has made some comments about the amendments to the Act and why they're significant. I've extracted those at paragraph 31. And suffice to say, he's of the view that the amendments make it easier to successfully apply in a case, easier than it was under the old provisions. I've referred at paragraph 32 to a decision in New South Wales re Fenwick. There's some more. It's helpful in talking about what it is that reasonably likely might mean, which is the term used in the New South Wales legislation. It's a little bit different, but the principles effectively are similar. Justice Palmer said in that decision, reasonably likely can mean fairly good chance that it is likely, or some reasonable people could think that it is likely, or some reasonable people could think that there is a fairly good chance that it's likely. So you'll find that very helpful, no doubt. The final case, there's actually two more cases. I'll be brief, Peter. The State Trustees in Haustorfer is a case that was heard earlier this year by Justice Habersberger, as is the case I've referred to at paragraph 35, re Macquarie. Justice Habersberger has made orders in those cases but hasn't delivered his reasons. Now, in Haustorfer, an elderly lady favoured her 3 children equally in her will. Her son was a merchant banker. He worked for Babcock and Brown, and his conduct indicated that he would have fitted in very well at Babcock and Brown because he helped himself to $540,000 of mum's money. And so his administrator commenced proceedings, judgment was entered for that sum plus a lot of interest. An application was made for a statutory will which he didn't defend. Justice Habersberger made orders approving the will. His reasoning was similar to Justice Mandy's reasoning in State Trustees and Hayden. The last case in paragraph 35 is Re Macquarie. This case was before His Honour about 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago. There was an intestacy. The estate would have gone to the granddaughter of this elderly gentleman. The application was made by the nephews and their wives of the elderly chap, who said, well, look, we've been on very good terms with Uncle Ron. Here's a will which will give us one-fifth each and the granddaughter a fifth as well. The application was dismissed. And I understand that His Honour will be handing down a judgment in that matter before I think His Honour's leaving the bench. And it will be a fairly comprehensive survey of the authorities in this area, because I didn't argue that case, but in Haustorfer, His Honour certainly was interested in this area and considered it to be pretty important and a pretty far-reaching power for the court to have. And so I think there'll be a judgment from His Honour shortly, which everyone should sort of keep your eyes out for. I've got some notes there at the end about costs. I won't go into those. Suffice to say, practitioners who are in the habit of thinking that costs should come out of the estate should note that in this jurisdiction that's not the case. Costs will follow the event. There's an explanation of why in the judgment of Her Honour Justice Dodge Streeton in Bolton and likewise Justice Byrne in Hill and Hill. So, thank you.
Jeremy, on behalf of the audience members, thank you for that presentation. It was illuminating as to the facts in particular that give rise to these applications and the change in the law that's meant that it's an easier threshold to achieve to obtain leave and then ultimately to succeed. But then with the rider, just beware of costs. This is not a particularly cost-friendly jurisdiction if you happen to get it wrong.